On July 30th, Bernie and I were privileged to speak with Richard Whittle. Richard is a Toronto-based football journalist who writes for The Guardian and New Yorker, amongst others, and currently edits Paste magazine, which, if you haven't heard of, you should go and look up. We spoke to him about his two main areas of expertise, data analytics and football finance, before moving on to cover Toronto FC and MLS, as well as previewing the new English Premier League season and discussing which teams have done the best transfer business. Enjoy, and find Richard on Twitter, at rwhittle. Here with Richard Whittle. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're very excited to talk to you today. We've been following your work for quite a while, since you were writing at The Score. I remember listening to you on the podcast and reading your column. So it's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's fun to be here. Thanks.
Should we start with FFP, one of your your specialist subjects is finance, football finance. Obviously, FFP is a massive topic at the moment. Most people don't really understand it. Most people complain about it. Some people think the concept is good, but the implementation is bad. What is your overall take of it? And then we'll get into more detail.
Sure. So I haven't written a lot about it lately, although there's been a few amendments. I guess UEFA's been putting through a few things. But generally, when it came out, I knew that UEFA's, you know, UEFA being UEFA, they're not economists, right? A lot of them are ex-footballers, or they're, you know, people with, I mean, some of them might be from formal positions in companies before they got involved in football administration. But generally, you know, for them, FFP is about punishing clubs that you know, spend too much money, which seems a little weird, because ideally the purpose of the legislation should be stopping clubs from spending themselves into administration, basically. And so it seemed weird, I think, to a lot of fans and the general public, and certainly to a lot of journalists, that the legislation seemed to be targeting, you know, clubs like PSG and Manchester City, who obviously have a ton of equity through very, very wealthy owners, and therefore are not in the same position as, like, say, a club in the Championship, which is, you know, spending beyond their means and ending up, you know, putting the club in a huge amount of jeopardy. And that seemed to be initially what the legislation was meant to address, and then it seemed to be just soaking the rich, right? So I can understand why there was a lot of backlash, because I think it was really poorly sold. But I think what UEFA probably should have done is to stress the fact that financial fair play was less about punishing clubs for spending a lot of money on players, but more in terms of sort of halting the inflation in wages in Europe, because you know, there's a competition to pay clubs or players as much money as possible at the top level. That trickles down to the, you know, the lower leagues, and then it means that clubs that are otherwise even financially responsible clubs have to spend wildly huge amounts of money just to compete, and it's not very fair. And so I always viewed financial fair play first and foremost as if you can keep clubs from spending what they actually take in revenue and not what they're, you know, not what their owners have in their pockets, then you might actually slowly begin to bring down the general, you know, transfer fees for players.
So let me ask you this way, because I tried to read as much of that document as I could.
Yeah, and it's boring.
It's so boring, like you said, and a lot of it actually is confusing and doesn't even seem to make sense to me.
Yeah.
But when I was reading through it, a lot of, they're talking about a lot of turnover, right? And they're talking about how much money you can spend compared to how much money you actually bring in to the club. They want it all to balance out, is at least what the long and short of it is. In the case of Manchester City, their balance sheets are saying that they are making a loss compared to, you know, all the transfers they were making. So on one end, I guess people could say that, sure, you're punishing these guys. How is they supposed to come up? They obviously need this rich,
right,
this rich owner. But I guess the question is, where does the money go? Who actually, like, who? How do you account for that money? Can you say it's this rich oligarch's money, or is it the club's money? How does it all really work out?
Well, I mean, I think the, you know, we don't want to get too technical, but I mean, UEFA has a fairly stringent process where they, you know, they audit clubs' books, and it becomes really apparent there where, you know, an owner is injecting their own equity into the book. So that's something that an accountant could probably come up with. Now, where it gets controversial is clubs will do some creative accounting. So, you know, I guess the best example was Manchester City writing off, I don't know, it was like 20 million pounds or something.
And Etihad gave them more sponsorship money or something.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, too. I mean, that's a whole separate thing. But basically, they're selling intellectual property to one of their sister clubs. I think it was New York City FC and one of the Melbourne clubs. And so, you know, a lot of people said, well, they're just moving money off the books, you know, to make themselves, or writing off losses so that they can, you know, they can make the numbers they need to in financial fair play. And fair enough, that's true. And other clubs have done things like, so these grotesque sponsorship deals with companies that may have ties with the owners.
Yeah.
That's a really big one. I think PSG was obviously a club that was maybe accused of doing that. And then the other thing is Chelsea and their loan system. So buying a lot of prospective young players who have a lot of value attached to them, and then just having them loaned out to various clubs in Europe, and they can do that an unlimited number of times.
You say various, but...
Yeah. Well, basically, the ones that they probably have a, you know, cozy business relationship with. Vitesse Arnhem was one, and Middlesbrough, and I think there was one other. So, there's definitely a lot of creative accounting involved, and it's not like perfect legislation, and it needed to be coupled with other things as well. There's no point in having... one of the biggest criticisms, I think it was a legitimate one, was that by punishing clubs that didn't yet have the commercial revenues of, say, like Manchester United and Arsenal, who already had a huge historical head start and weren't always financially responsible getting there. Obviously, Man United's the biggest example with the Glazer leverage buyout. But anyway, it's totally unfair that the newer clubs are now being punished for something that older clubs had an advantage before. So I think there's things that UEFA could address, but I think... getting angry at financial fair play for not addressing those issues is kind of it's not a real problem, because UEFA could come in and say, well, we can introduce additional legislation to say there needs to be money sharing or greater equity between the clubs and seeing if there's interest in doing that as well. So I don't think like financial fair play is perfect. I think there's a huge amount of flaws with it, but I think if the end result is to bring the general prices down in the transfer market, I think that's a good thing, because it means that, again, that has a trickle-down effect. And the clubs we really should be talking about aren't the Manchester Cities and the PSGs necessarily. It's the clubs in the championships who have to spend a lot of money just to survive, let alone...
Find a rich oligarch.
But this is like the silly thing, right? It's like you read a Martin Samuel column in the Daily Mail. It's like... The Manchester City model is like the most impossible to recreate model. You know, it's just like so irresponsible to say to clubs, you know, just pray for an oligarch to come save the day, because this is so unrealistic.
Do you think that a lot of what... Well, let me phrase the question this way, because I look at MLS, for example, and a lot of people are saying that the one entity model will not allow MLS to grow in the way that they hope that it will. That it's stifling, and you hear a lot of players talking about it, you know, let clubs spend whatever they want to spend. And I feel like on the other side of the pond, you know, UEFA looking at it and they're saying, no, don't do that, because that keeps you tight, and, you know, that keeps their affairs regulated closely. And I wonder if UEFA kind of look at that, maybe not the whole thing, but kind of look at it and think, you know, we'd like to have at least that level of control.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say, like, Major League Soccer should be a model for, like, because there's a point where, you know, I was writing a review, so I do I think every other week I do, like, a preview for the MLS, for The Guardian, and it's harder and harder to write, because there's so much equity that there's very little movement between the clubs. So we're literally halfway through the season. We just had the MLS All-Star game, and you can see that there's such a tight spread between the clubs in both conferences. Now, there's other factors involved like the fact that there are conferences is one. The fact there's no relegation promotion, I think, skews things as well. MLS, I think, it had to be that way in a lot of ways, obviously, to survive a very difficult North American sports market, but I don't think it should be a model necessarily. Like, UEFA doesn't have to go that far to ensure that there's no, you know, that there's financial safeguards. They don't have to go, like, the MLS model, I think, is really special, and I think it would be impossible to recreate in Europe for a whole bunch of different reasons.
The last thing I want to sort of ask you on financial fair play is, it seems to me, and a lot of things I read, are that the timing of the relaxation of FFP from UEFA is, you know, it's perfectly in line with the new TV deal for the Premier League.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that there was a lot of pressure from France, from Spain, Germany, to say, you need to take these restrictions off us, because these guys have more money, right, coming in. So obviously we have the FFP, but they can spend even more regardless of that. it's not a fair playing field. Do you think that was one of the contributors to that?
It could have been. I mean, I think that's a good theory. It is really weird. I mean, literally the clubs in England have more money than they can spend. And I think the problem is that there's now legislation that it's not like a completely open market where, because, you know, even the smallest Premier League clubs are so flush with TV cash that they can buy whatever player they want in the world. I think there's domestic rules in place to make sure that they're not overrun with foreign players now. So I think that as much as they have a ton of money, and there's definitely, I think, a risk of a talent drain. You know, you see a lot of really talented players in Spain going off to England and maybe being wasted in a lot of cases because they're not always with the most tactically adept managers. But that said, I think I don't think the wealth of the Premier League is going to threaten. Is the biggest existential threat to, you know, leagues like La Liga or the Bundesliga. I think that they have their own issues they need to solve. And I think, you know, some of them are already in perfectly good health and don't necessarily need to aspire to the wealth of the Premier League to succeed. Yeah.
But would you say the relaxing of these rules at the time where the two Milan clubs have got new investment, I mean, surely that will do good things for Serie A. I mean, we've already seen the caliber of players that those two teams are buying this summer mm-hmm. is a lot greater than it has been for the last few years.
Yeah, but like the issue in Serie A, I think has less to do with buying better players. It's, I mean, even the richest oligarch wouldn't want to walk into a Serie A club and say, "Hey, take all my money, do whatever you want with it. I'll buy all the players you want in the world." Like, I think their issues have much more to do with the fact that almost, except for Juventus, all the stadiums are municipally owned, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so it's very, very difficult for a club like Napoli. I mean, De Laurentiis has been whining about this for years now. It's very difficult for owners to improve their stadiums. And if they don't improve their stadiums, they can't attract crowds. And if they can't attract crowds, they can't attract sponsors. And they can't get commercial deals. And they can't build the revenue base they need to compete with leagues like the Bundesliga and La Liga, which are their main competitors at this point. So I think if you look in each domestic league, their issues aren't necessarily we need to spend more money on players to compete. It's like there's a whole bunch of different issues. Like in Spain, the issue is mostly the fact they have an incredibly inequitable TV deal, and right. They have huge amounts of debt because the Spanish economy has been terrible for so long. So I think it's a little simplistic to say. Yeah, and maybe you're right, and you're probably right. I mean, there's probably a bit of quid pro quo that was going on in UEFA with people saying, "Hey, you know, we want to get in this game too. We can't compete with England unless you relax the rules." But at the same time, I think the problems in the other leagues are a lot of, you know, local problems. Yeah.
Awesome. I want to talk a bit more about, you know, analytics and proliferation of data in football right now. I was listening to, I don't know if you listen to Graham Hunter's big interviews.
Sometimes.
I love him. In a recent one he did with David Moyes, David Moyes was talking about analytics and how he believes that it's made football better than it was in the past, because you can literally look at the nitty gritty of even a player's, just his health,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you can see maybe at this time of the year he's better, whatever. You can make a lot of inferences from those. The question is, there's some people who say, you know, it takes the natural flair or whatever out of the game. Do you subscribe to that, or do you think that analytics are actually making the game even better?
Well, I mean, this is interesting. Like, it depends. So this is the thing that I always get curious about. It's like when someone like David Moyes says that they love data, they love analytics, we can confuse a lot of concepts, right? Because when I think of analytics, I think of guys who take large data sets and they run what they call regressions and they try to see if there's any meaningful trends, you know, in the statistical noise. So if teams are doing more of X behavior on the field, is there more of a Y result? So whether or not that's higher points on the table or more goals or whatever. So that to me is the work of analytics. And I think when you talk to a lot of managers, they see analytics as just the data itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that you have a lot of managers who say, "Well, I love data. I want the numbers." You might have a Sam Allardyce or a David Moyes. The problem is they might see those numbers and they're not statisticians. So they might see a number that's low and want that to be higher for their own reasons, right? So, you know, they might think that if their team's not fouling enough, then it's not they're not being aggressive enough on the pitch.
That's not necessarily the whole story.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a team that fouls a lot might actually be conceding possession a lot, might be, you know, mm-hmm. and so it might not necessarily be a good thing.
Was this the Yap stat?
Yeah, that's the famous example, right? This is the great thing that, I mean, it's a good teachable moment, I guess. But so the Yapstam was famously, they picked him up because they liked him because he was tackling a lot, I think. And then they realized, they didn't like him because he wasn't tackling enough.
His ratio of tackles went down.
Yeah. So they're like, well, what's going on? He's not doing his job. And so they, sold him on. And then they realized, well, the reason that's, you don't want a defender to tackle because it means that they're making a last gas challenge. They haven't done their job leading up to that moment.
Which is more dangerous.
Yeah, exactly.
In many cases.
And it can lead to a lot of free kicks and dangerous situations. So my issue is that, there's a lot of, people want to talk to managers about analytics, and I think that the part of the problem is that they see, the advances in the technology in terms of data collection. They see that as analytics, and so they don't see that there's this added job of a guy or they actually come in and say, you can't just look at this data and make decisions based on what you think is good and bad, because then you could lead to a whole. There's all sorts of unforeseen circumstances that could come.
You actually have to go through it.
Yeah, you have to run.
Draw conclusions.
And you need guys who are really smart to do it. You need guys who have economics degrees or PhD. PhD.
Speaking of which, Liverpool, I think in 2012 they created a new position, director of research, and they hired. I don't know what his name was, but he has an engineering degree or something or the other, and. It hasn't really helped them on the pitch, really. Maybe the season, 2012 coincides when they made their big run for the league, 2012, 2013. No, sorry, 2013.
13, 14.
14.
Maybe, yeah.
But I would love to be a fly on the wall during the meeting with, this director of research and Brendan Rodgers and see if anything soaks in whatsoever. Yeah.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, it's really tempting to say, well, look at like a club, look at any club. It's just so easy to nitpick and say, well, they've hired this analyst and they're not successful. And so therefore analytics sucks. And it's like, well, first of all, you have to know what's the position of power that person has in that club. What's their specific job? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times you get a really talented analyst who's hired by a club and all they end up doing at the club is building a database. And then at that point they have this huge Herculean task of convincing the manager that, hey, if you tried this instead in these circumstances, you'll get, you might get a few extra goals and therefore, you might move up the table this much. So I think it's really, I wrote a column for this, I think, a few months ago for 21st Club. But the problem with us on the outside, whether we're fans or media, is that we're always looking at the club from the outside in. And so all we're seeing is the results, both in terms of the players that are recruited in the transfer market and the results on the table itself. And so we have to make inferences based on what the, who the club has hired and what image they're, portraying to the world about how seriously they take analytics. And that's very, very difficult to do. We're only getting half the story a lot of the times.
So are you saying that a lot of cases clubs will hire someone to do what they see as analytics, but they're not really sure what it is they're asking that person to do?
Exactly.
And so that person then has to, A, figure out what their role is, and B, convince the higher-ups that what they're doing is of value.
That's absolutely the case. And so that's the huge problem is that I spoke about this once. It's like imagine a job where you're hiring a position. You don't even know what the position is. And you don't even know the value of the position. You just know
that
your competitors
that
are doing the same thing.
Right.
You've heard that you need one. But that's only like hiring an analyst is like maybe 5% of the job. The rest is like, what is that analyst doing all day? What information is that analyst producing? Are they, is it worthwhile information? And is that information being taken seriously by decision makers at the club? Not just the manager, but the scout, the chairman, because a lot of these things are decisions that are made in the transfer market. So I think analysts are just barely getting their foot in the door, let alone making decisions. And I think that's why clubs like FC Michelin in Denmark and Brentford in England are really the ones to follow, because they're the clubs who are real, true believers in a database approach.
Yeah, on that topic of Brentford and Michelin, and I think to an extent from what I've heard, Southampton, I've been trying to wrap my head around this of how clubs use analytics to actually not just scout but make reports on players that they want to bring in. Because it's one thing if it's your own players, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have access to them all the time, and then you can run your tests they need to run. I always wondered, how do these guys actually collect data to analyze on players that they want to bring in? Like, what's the process? They don't have an advanced version of Football Manager that we use, right? Do they? Or,
well, that's a really awesome point. And actually, that's a huge problem is that, this is like a far-off concern, but there's, down the line, you know, the leagues that don't necessarily, it could come to the point where if there are enough technical scouts working at the biggest clubs in Europe that if they don't have the data sets they need in certain leagues to make decisions, you know, they might move to another league that does. So it could be a point of that if a league isn't hiring a data company to gather information on their players, they might not be able to sell as many to more lucrative leagues. But I think that's a far off concern. I think in the short term, this is actually a really fun moment for analysts because they have to be super creative. And you know, I think in the media we have this image that analytics is all about, like, and we spoke about this earlier, like it's all about huge data sets mm-hmm. and really complex, graphs and you know, stuff about the heart rate of players and all this stuff and how many yards they ran and how quickly they did. But I think a lot of the times analysts have to be sort of like MacGyver. They have to do what they can with very, very small bits of information. But I think even those, I don't think we've even yet fully explored just using shot data and maybe even pass completion data, what we can do in terms of being creative about figuring out, well, our players contributing and what's a good player and what would make sense for a player to buy for our team if we need a left back or a center back or whatever. Right. So I think this is a really fun time and really cool time for really creative analysts to have a lot of fun with sort of...
If I take it to international football, I was trying to... I mean, we have all these conversations all the time, and Mo earlier was alluding to how it sucks that Brazil are no longer the force that we all grew up, you know, watching and all that. And I tried to think to myself, why is that the case? Mm-hmm. You know, why is it now that the European nations, let it be Germany or Spain or maybe even Belgium, seem to have, you know, superseded those nations? And I wonder, I don't have the answer because I'm not, you know, a fly on the wall there, but I wonder if this is sort of maybe the more analytical detail of, let's say, I'm pretty sure the Germans are pretty analytical in, mm-hmm. in the way that they perceive football. Mm-hmm. And you would think that, you know, the Brazilians, Argentinians, not so much. Maybe the free-flowing Jogo Benito concept.
Right.
But I wonder if that's something that maybe you knew about or can see as a difference between the two.
Well, it's interesting. There's actually quite a few analysts in Brazil, which was sort of surprising. But I think they exist in a Portuguese-speaking bubble at this moment. But I think they're pretty serious about what they do. And I would imagine, although I don't know very well, that they're the same in Argentina. But I think, you know, Argentina, they were World Cup finalists in a year when, you know, Messi probably wasn't at his peak form. So I think the Brazil's problem is probably more, it's probably much more mundane. Like it's probably just a developmental issue. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of really smart people who would just say that it's an issue with the type of players that clubs are creating. The fact that I think, you know, this has been a problem for a long time is that a lot of football pitches have been disappearing from Brazil, and it's a lot harder for kids to just get practice time. And there's more and more elite academies, so it's becoming much more pay to play in the nation where kids used to grow up in favelas and kick a ball and get on the national team. So I think there's a lot of reasons why Brazil is falling behind. I don't necessarily think cutting edge analytics at the national. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, Brazil in some ways were pioneers because they, you know, they were using probably useless but really intense data as far back as their first World Cup win in 1958. You know, they were doing all sorts of studies on. They were actually pioneers in terms of diet, mm-hmm. controlling fitness, diet, and things, yeah. like fitness, mm-hmm. and those were obviously clear factors for team success. So I think Brazil are probably pioneers in that regard, and I think their issues are probably a little more political than analytics based. But it'd be interesting.
Awesome. Let's get off the heavy stuff and talk some light stuff. You want to go?
Yeah. All right. So we were talking briefly about MLS earlier.
Yes.
We have to talk about our local team, Toronto.
All right. Let's
you are
do it.
From Toronto, right?
Yeah. I grew up here. Yeah.
Consider yourself a fan?
Yeah, I'm a weird fan.
I think that's the sentiment a lot of people can share.
Yeah.
So let's go back. So you grew up in Toronto, you're a football fan. Maybe let's tangent there. So how did that happen? Where did the love of football come from?
Oh, that's a good question. My first experience watching soccer was probably the 1994 World Cup. So I was 13 at the time. I played it as a kid, but you know, you play it as a kid, you don't know that it's like It's like Foursquare. It'd be like me finding out there isn't like Foursquare was the most popular sport on the planet. So I remember watching with my uncle, and I just, I don't know. So there's something about the fact that there was no interruption by ads. I just thought that was mind blowing, and the fact that it was this gorgeous green pitch, and I think the fact that there were very few, you know, this is the 94 World Cup, so I didn't know any better, but there were very few interruptions in play. So I thought it just was it was just stunning to me. I'd never seen a sport like that before in my life. So as a North American, and I grew up watching baseball, and I was a huge Blue Jays fan. I think that was. It was huge. It was major. It was revelatory. Like, it was just sort of blew my mind a little. So I gradually got into it. But I really my interest in the club game really took off when I was in university. This is way back in like 2000 when I was in McGill, Montreal. Like, I watched a few club games, but I started watching it pretty much religiously, like every weekend and weekdays from then on in. So that's when it really picked up steam. And then I guess it was 2007, I started writing a blog, and then I did a lot of research in Canadian soccer history. And so I'm kind of a newbie. Like, I talked to a lot of people, and most of the, I'm really impressed that a lot of the hardcore Canadian soccer contingent, a lot of the guys who are in the South Stand at BMO have been into football since like the 80s. And in some cases, they were guys who were showing up at Varsity Stadium to watch the Blizzard, you know, back in, or even Metro's Croatia maybe. So there's a, so I'm late to the game as far as the Canadian side is concerned, I've loved football for a long time. Yeah.
Okay. So you must have been. I mean, you say you're a weird kind of fan of Toronto FC, but you must have been somewhat excited when Toronto finally had an MLS club.
Yeah, man. I was totally. I don't know. It was totally surreal. It was the most surreal. It was totally surreal to see it. I remember I went to the first game, Toronto FC's first game, and it was just really stunning to see.
Did you throw your seat cover?
I did, yeah. Actually, that was their fourth game, I think.
Right, passage.
That was the May. Yeah, I did throw my seat cover, actually. I remember I took a friend of mine who's now actually in England. He's a singer, and we took him on a free ticket, and it was just, we had no idea what to expect. We thought they would lose again, but it ended up being pretty awesome. So, but yeah, I mean, I still remember that first season very, very fondly. I still to this day, you know, I can't believe it's actually happened. If I think about it, it's very strange. Like Didier Drogba showing up in Montreal, so
yeah,
where I watch games, you know, in a bar on Saint-Laurent for years. I'm still coming to terms with it. Yeah, it's still very strange. Yeah.
So I know what happened with me is that the club, you know, I came here in 2006. The club was born in 2007. I thought, this is fantastic. I went to a couple of games the first season. And then, as the years wore on, I gradually became more and more disappointed and more and more disillusioned. It was a shambles for a very long time. We seem to be on an upward turn. Are we, or is this another fall storm?
I think that if Toronto FC failed to make the playoffs, based on everything we know... you know, I think Giovinco's health is questionable for this weekend, so already there's like reason for doom and gloom, maybe. But and obviously Bradley being out for 7 to 10 days. But that said, I think I would be very, very surprised if Toronto doesn't make the playoffs this season. That's not saying I expect them to make a run, but I think that there's high hopes that they'll definitely. I mean, it would be. There's a lot of competition, and I think that people shouldn't take it for granted that it's going to happen. And if it doesn't happen, it will be for the reason that, you know, Drogba maybe miraculously echoed his Chelsea form for the impact, and you know, Lampard's health improved and is, you know, matched up with Pirlo brilliantly for New York City FC, and you know, there'd be a lot of factors at play to see Toronto fall out of the running. But I think. I'm pretty certain that this is the year. I'd be very surprised if it wasn't.
We were in this exact position last year.
Yeah.
You know, Defoe had a very hot start. I think Giovinco has been miles better,
yes.
In my opinion. But they were there.
Yeah.
And collapsed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm hoping that this injury to Giovinco doesn't have the same effect as the injury or disappearance of Defoe, and then it all comes crumbling down.
Right? Yeah. It could happen. I mean, Toronto, they've conceded like 12 goals in their last like four games or something crazy. Like,
well, this is what I was thinking. Like, this team is reminding me of Keegan's Newcastle.
Yeah, 95.
Just going for it, you know, scoring four, conceding three.
Yeah.
The only difference is There's a bit more wiggle room because they can finish in the top few positions or top. Because
they added more teams, right? I think it was. Well, no, there's more. It's like 8 teams from each conference go to the playoffs now.
Right. So, you know, technically, I think it's harder not to do it than to do it, but somehow Toronto FC have managed.
Yeah, there's always room to find a way. The thing is, the difference is that, I don't know, everyone had a different opinion, and I think there was a lot of hindsight involved, but I think when Ryan Nelson was sacked, I think a lot of people didn't feel like it was the worst decision in the world.
No,
whether or not they had reservations about the managerial change base, a lot of their concerns were more based on the history of Toronto FC firing managers and less about their belief in Ryan Nelson. So for example, if Vanny was sacked this season, I think there would be riots at BMO Field. Not because Vanny's necessarily the most beloved manager of all time, but I think there's a sense that there's enough cohesion going on in this, you know, admittedly the most expensive team in MLS. There's enough visible cohesion on the attacking side that I think that people are willing to accept what is probably one of the more shadier defenses in the top half of the Eastern Conference right now.
Just signed them a defender.
Yes, Moroccan. Another one from Ligue 1.
Yeah.
Is he any good?
I have
Anyone
no clue.
Have any idea?
I think he spent most of his career with Brest in France. This is not a high-profile signing. But we'll see. I mean, frankly, defensively, anything's got to be better than the last little while. So,
yeah,
you know, there's always hope.
There's also a lot of... It hasn't been very consistent back there either in terms of personnel. So, they're still figuring it out, unfortunately. Be nice. We could sort it out, but there it is. Yeah.
I mean, I figured out that Craval shouldn't be in the team a long time ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why this is still happening, but, you know, there you go. Finally, on MLS, and going back to a slightly more serious topic, do you think MLS has a problem developing Canadian talent? Because, we've spoken to Paul Stalteri and Bruce Grobbelaar, and both of them have pointed to the NASL as possibly a better breeding ground.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I don't know if MLS has a problem developing players. I think the problem is that they can't do it on their own. For the raw reason that there's only three, you know, there's three professional clubs in Canada. I'll take that back. Sorry, Ben Nasty.
Don't want to offend Edmonton.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's three MLS clubs with academies, and they can't do the job of an entire, you know, national league. I have a lot to say on this topic, in part because I helped, write a bit and edit a study commissioned by the CSA in a Division II. That led to, we actually said it's a little premature based on the financials right now, but we recommended a U23 development league. And I think that there needs to be an infrastructure already in place, national infrastructure that's really clear. So we know that we propose like a CHL model where you have the three corridors, so in Quebec, Ontario, and BC, and they sort of each produce a champion and they can play each other off or whatever in a cup final. And that was sort of our ideal. But that's just to say, I think MLS has done fine based on the resources that they've had,
okay.
But they can't do it on their own. There's a whole missing level. There's a missing link between what's going on, you know, at the provincial associations and what's going on in Major League Soccer. And I think, you know, a lot of people really want a proper division, Canadian-only professional Division II. I think that's an amazing, you know, an amazing goal, but I think for now we need to actually even build a tier below that to make that realistic, because there's no player pool, it won't work. Yeah.
We did go to the opening game, I think it was, of Toronto, Internacional de Toronto.
Oh, wow.
In League One Ontario.
Oh, nice.
And Alberto Solano was manager, and
I know, blew my mind.
Yeah.
A fan,
we went there, met him very briefly. He didn't have too much to say, and then
a few
weeks later it all fell apart.
Yeah, well, it was maybe a little predictable.
It did look a bit dodgy.
Yeah.
The whole outfit looked a bit dodgy.
Yeah, we felt uncomfortable the whole time. We were supposed to be the media there, which was...
I remember going to... This is the old CSL, and talk about dodgy. We don't need to talk about that too much, but I remember watching the... Croatia? Croatia playing... what's their rival Balkans team? I can't remember. But anyways,
I was gonna say Serbia, but
there was more police presence there at that game, and there was maybe 300 fans or something. Yeah. There was more police presence at that game than I've ever even seen at BMO. So yeah, there's a lot of weird local soccer history in this city. So yeah, it's kind of funny. I don't want it to be that way.
No, of course.
But yeah, I mean, a CSA, they don't have the long arms of the law. So it's really hard for them to ensure that their sanctioned clubs are above board. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
If we can move on to talk a bit about your craft, so football journalism, or one of your crafts. You've been outspoken in the past, I think, about what you see as possibly a poor level of coverage or analysis provided by some media outlets and journalists. I remember, for example, reading a piece that you wrote, I think it was in 2014, about Martin Demichelis,
mm-hmm.
who, so I think Barcelona just played Manchester City in the Champions League. Demichelis had been sent off, and the kind of standard narrative was,
yeah,
Demichelis was awful, what a stupid challenge, he put the whole team at risk, mm-hmm. and that's why they lost. Your analysis said that Demichelis at the time was actually the only player reading the game properly. Why is it, in your opinion, that journalists settle on these kind of standard or possibly lazy narratives?
Yeah, I think it's difficult because I don't want to blame journalists because they're in the worst position because they're content machines, right? Like the guys who get the most attention are the newspaper guys, and a lot of the times they're beat writers. And the reason they get a lot of attention is because they get, realistically, it's because they get the best information the earliest, and so they let fans know that as quickly as possible. But they're also, their secondary job is to write game reports, and a lot of the times, you know, that means that they have to make conclusions almost immediately, you know, but match reports, for example, on the whistle match reports, which are the most stressful thing. I've mm-hmm. done a few of them, and I hate doing them because you have to have clean, beautiful copy ready to press send as soon as the final whistle is blown. And that's the hardest thing to do, I think, in any area of sports journalism. So I think they have a really difficult job. So I've written a lot of angry things about various journalists that I maybe want to walk back a bit now, but I think that the problem is that it's less journalists themselves, and I think it's unfortunately the demands of the form. You know, it's just really, fans expect it. It's very hard to write a compelling match report that doesn't rely on, you know, passionate conclusions that probably are a little knee jerk and obvious and maybe not the whole story. So I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that all the time, but I think it needs to be coupled with sober second thoughts sometimes, or maybe a bit of a... we need to sort of keep football at a distance sometimes. You need a break from it. And journalists are paid not to ever do that. And I think, unfortunately, they're put in a really difficult position that way. So I think it's less them, and I think it's more the situation they've been put in. Yeah.
So I would agree with that. And I mean, one of the notes I have here is, you know, is deadlines are a reason.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, moving away from match reports... another example would perhaps be the leaving of Brentford of Mark Warburton.
Mm-hmm.
And the reporting of that was, in the main, that's a disgrace. Look at the brilliant job he's done.
Yeah.
How can you replace someone like that? Whereas there wasn't much focus on the fact that the owner had implemented the system at Midland and wanted to do the same with Brentford, and look at the success he's had here, and that's the reason this is happening.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in that situation, presumably people would have more time to research, look into what's going on.
Oh, yeah, that happens all the time, and I think that's unfortunate, and I don't think there's any excuses for that. I think, unfortunately... So, I mean, that's a really interesting example you bring up, because that's something where we get angry a lot of... You know, I get angry at Martin Samuel maybe once every 2 months for writing something boneheaded, but The Guardian is another good example. It's a paper that, you know, it's very... They have their own weird kind of sort of more leftist conservatism where for them it's... They want football to be like what it was in the 80s without all the hooliganism, right? So it was better when it was just a... You know, a gaffer, and they, you know, the guys would come out with the bucket and the cloth,
the magic sponge,
yeah, the magic sponge to fix all injuries. And I think unfortunately, they look at the old days with a bit of rose tinted glasses a bit. And part of that means that anytime an owner makes a decision, they act as a manager. you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, it's this newfangled age we live in where managers aren't given a chance. And they're not, they don't necessarily take the time to look at the bigger picture. But, you know, there's other people who can counter those narratives. You know, Sean Ingle's existence in The Guardian, for example, is really great. And, you know, I really like Jonathan Liu at the Telegraph as well. So people are willing to say, hang on, let's maybe look at this a different way. Maybe it's not as obvious as you think it is. And but also at the same time, not being contrarian for contrarianism's sake. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about your craft to journalism. So there are a few of us that really enjoy silly season.
Right.
You know, the trans rumors and all this. And there are a few of us who just detest it completely. Right. Now, my only question is, do journalists make some stuff up? Because some of the rumors I read don't make sense. And I always wonder, where does that come from?
I don't know that they make stuff up. I just think that different journalists at different papers have different standards, right? So in the United States, and I don't want to make draw generalizations, but in the U.S., it would be very hard-pressed to see a mainstream reporter tweet a transfer rumor unless they had, you know, double confirmation. Like, seriously, like, they... And I mean, like, separate double confirmation. And that's a very difficult thing to get, which is why it's very rare that you see, you know, a lot of journalists in the United States, you know, clamoring over each other to tweet the transfer rumors, in part because MLS doesn't really work that way. But in England, I've discovered over the past few years, it doesn't work that way. A lot of people, there's a lot of pressure. There's a huge amount. I mean, you know this. There's a ton of dailies. Yeah. They're all in competition with each other. You know, to sell papers, to get attention on social media, to build bigger followings. And so if they have a guy in the past who's been right about a transfer, and it might even be someone who's not even closely connected to the club, they just know a guy, they might choose to run with it. And there was a few times I had some good sources, like I could have broken the Sir Alex Ferguson retirement story, and I had already just covered someone who... You know, another reporter who wasn't as scrupulous with their sources, so I was like, nope, I'm going to wait and I'll see if I can confirm it. But had I gone ahead and just tweeted it anyway, you know, you get a ton of followers that way and you get a lot of recognition, and there's a temptation to like, hey, it worked this time, I'll just do it again in future. But that's how you get burned, is that if you have one anonymous source, it doesn't matter how many times they're right, they're going to be wrong at some point, and if you're not careful, you get burned for it.
Right.
Yeah. And it happens even in baseball now, so it's not necessarily limited to the UK. Like we saw yesterday with that poor Mets player crying on the field.
Yeah, that was brutal.
Yeah.
A happier day in baseball today, though, at least for the Blue Jays.
Mm-hmm.
So you were talking earlier about a kind of divergence of attitudes and different kind of ways that people are covering football. I would say now that there's more independent coverage and analysis than there's ever been.
Right.
Meanwhile, mainstream media football jobs are harder and harder to come by, and probably less and less well paid. In terms of football journalism,
yeah.
In terms of football journalism as a career, you know, on the one hand, we're exposed to a much greater variety of coverage. On the other hand, people are having to contribute it for free or next to no money.
Yeah.
What are the pros and cons? And where are we headed?
I don't know. That's something I need to know. I think everyone needs to know who has an interest in it, because it's really hard. I mean, there's a lot of people who want to write about football and do it for a living, because it's like, it's just a great thing to do. It's better than sitting in an office. I think the problem is that a lot of younger writers, the real thing now is that you have to do almost the hardest work early now in your career as opposed to later. So you almost have to be willing to take the biggest dares sooner. And then once you're recognized a bit, then you know, you get moved up in the system or whatever. So I think there's still a path that's available. I think it's a really narrow, difficult path to take, and it's very hard. And it involves really young, green behind the ears people who have no experience in working in a newspaper or a network. Maybe they've interned. They have to really, really be bold in pitching really solid stories to news outlets, and that means making difficult, scary phone calls, which even I, you know, I've now been doing this for how many years, and it's still really hard for me to really push, and you really need that journalistic drive. And it's amazing to me, because I've been an editor as well. I was an editor when I was at The Score, and I do some editing for Paste. And it's amazing to me the number of pitches where they've not done any any groundwork whatsoever. And now it's like I've been doing this long enough that if I'm in a position where I have a budget and I can pay a writer and I see that they've really done something special with, I'll pay them well above like our skill rate, because that stuff to me is valuable. Like the future of sports media is, it's not, you know, unless you're a Brian Phillips who can write like gorgeous, gorgeous prose every single time and be someone who I read from top to bottom. If you don't have that, you really now need to get out in the weeds, like really hardcore, and get sources, get connections, and really learn how to tell amazing, compelling stories and do it over and over and over again enough that you can pitch it. But in terms of getting hired in staff positions, like, unless, if you're an amazing tweeter, that's probably your route now. Like, I know more people have gotten jobs in social media and sports than actual proper journalism jobs. So yeah, I don't have the answers at all. I wish I did. I think about it every day, and I don't get any closer to a conclusion, unfortunately.
Fair enough. Yeah. Very finally on this topic, and just very quickly, where do you go for your football content? What are your go-tos?
Oh, God, I read everything, man. I read, the Guardian's like basically been my homepage for 10 years. But I read all the English dailies, pretty much. I read Reddit, because there's always something I've missed that flips up there, and there's always something funny. I don't know. I'm on Twitter way too much, because a lot of the times you can skip the middleman. Oh, Nuzzle. That's my big thing now. Do you guys know about Nuzzle?
I don't know about Nuzzle.
I don't know.
So Nuzzle is the best. So I hate Twitter because I follow too many people and I miss too many stories. And Nuzzle, what Nuzzle does is that it finds links that have been tweeted or talked about by, you know, influential people that you follow. And it just puts them all in a row for you. So it's like an RSS feed for your Twitter, basically.
Very cool.
And it solves the you know, forever Twitter problem of constantly having to check in and see if you've missed something.
We're on Twitter a lot, so yeah. That might be useful.
Yeah. Yeah. Nuzzle is great.
So there you go, people. Go and get Nuzzled. Yeah. All right. Final topic. The English Premier League.
All right.
Which starts back up... almost too soon.
Yeah,
I think we were talking
about
this.
I'm not ready for it at all.
I think the most important question before we can say any more is, what team do you have a favorite EPL team?
I follow Villa, Aston Villa. That's my team.
Did not see that coming. Therefore, you are approved.
Yeah.
I had a suspicion because I saw you tweeting about Adebayor earlier today.
Well,
why don't we start then? I mean, what do you think of Aston Villa's business this summer?
It's good for the financials. Like, we've done a bit of good business, which is always nice.
And on the pitch.
Yeah, I think we may have soaked Liverpool a little bit, which is something that's good. But unfortunately, like, you know, because of Randy Lerner, that money's probably going into a giant pit. But I think, I don't know, to me it's always wait and see. I think I like Tim Sherwood. I didn't like him when he first came, but, you know, you make an FA Cup final, I think that's good enough for me. And he kept the club up. He's a compelling man manager, which Lambert certainly wasn't. So I think, we picked up Adebayor. We have a few other pieces here and there, Aguirre or whatever. So I think, I don't know, I'm hopeful, yeah.
My question is Graham Carr selling his information to Aston Villa now?
I have no idea.
He seems to be buying up Liga.
Yeah.
Adebayor aside, Jordan Ayew seems like a shrewd signing.
Yeah. No, I think they're good. I think it's good. I think it's like what the signings you'd want to see at this point. It's just... I think everyone has this vision of Tim as the person who's going to, you know, motivate players who may not have been in the right fit before. So there's a number of players in the Premier League who fit that profile. So whether or not he can do it enough to this season. But I don't know where this club's going right now. That's the biggest issue. And I know Lerner's been interested in selling for a while now. There was rumors last year I was hearing that it was going to be sold imminently and then never came to pass. So I think it's sort of to shit or get off the pot at this point for the ownership. And it would be nice if... I don't know if I want Sherwood there when the money, you know, starts to come in properly. But, you know, like, Villa's been a sleeping giant for so long. It's just nice to see moves that aren't necessarily moves that are worthy of a club that's aiming for 16th as opposed to 10th, maybe. You know?
Yeah. Well, I feel bad because I forget who it was, but I was speaking to someone on Twitter the other day, a Villa fan, who said, it's just nice at the moment When you compare it with Martin O'Neill, who refused to buy anyone other than British players.
Yeah, and extremely expensive ones at that. And successful ones, but at a huge cost to the club. And the other thing, too, is that they've done some off-field moves, like with director of football, and that they've hired someone who I can't say in the analytics field, who I know is very, very talented, who I'm personally very happy about. So they've done some things off the pitch that I'm looking forward to, but may not have an effect until next season, probably. Right. Yeah.
Across the league, you know, outside of Aston Villa, what do you think? Who do you think has done the best business, and which signings are you most excited to see?
Oh, brother! I mean, it was kind of funny to see. I don't know if it's the best signings, but it's kind of funny to see Manchester United actually lining up a series of players, telegraphing it to the world that these are the players they're targeting, and having them all show up with the club in rapid succession. But I mean, there's almost the risk that it's a PR, you know, it's a PR stunt. And I'm really curious about, you know, Louis van Gaal. I mean, he's a very talented manager, but Manchester United are very weird under him. Like, a lot of backward passes, a lot of passes to the center halves. And so they have this incredibly talented midfield now and some other pieces. And it's just be very interesting to see what kind of
seems like
kind
a
of
talented
team.
Midfield, but no one's going to play in their actual position.
Yeah,
which is a little bit concerning.
Yeah, exactly. So where are they shuffled, and where are people moved, and is Memphis Depay? I mean, he's an amazing signing for that club. I really like him as a young player. So it'd be interesting to see. But yeah, they've been curious. The other ones, it's not been too noisy so far.
No.
Yeah, transfer movements.
Raheem Sterling was noisy.
Yeah. But, I mean, that was long and protracted and was more about Raheem Sterling than it was about City necessarily. Or it was probably more about Liverpool, I think.
Sure. I guess Liverpool have been pretty noisy, too. You know, Milner, Ings, Benteke.
Firmino.
Yeah. It's a lot of Klein.
Yeah, but, you know, I was reading this, not to talk about analytics too much again, but I read this post by this guy. I think it was Dustin Ward who wrote it, but just noticing that James Milner, if he's going to be used as this midfield engine at Liverpool, actually he's quite poor, essentially, at moving the ball forward in the midfield.
Him,
yeah, exactly. So that might not be the best idea, unfortunately, for that club. And Benteke, I don't know. I think a lot of people are like, well, he takes a lot of crosses, but I think that's actually kind of BS. But they're not signings. They're not like Champions League signings, you know? They're signings of a club that...
Paying $32.5 million for Benteke and $30 million for Firmino.
Yeah. But I think that's unfortunately, I think that's a sign of the fact that Liverpool's stuck. They're in a position where they're not the club they once were, but they know they're owned by FSG, and they also know that they're in a very flush Premier League at the moment, and they have their legacy and their commercial value as well. Mm-hmm. And that kind of screws them in a lot of ways, because they have to pay a premium that their competitors don't. So, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Do you see anything different happening in the Premier League this year, or do you see it being very much status quo? I mean, if you were to predict the top four, do you think we're going to see anything different?
No, I think it'll probably come down again to Chelsea and Man United, or Manchester City for the top spot.
Oh, you almost said Man United. Yeah. I was going to get happy.
No, sorry. I mean, it could happen. I think Man United will probably make third, fourth. But I don't... from a narrative standpoint, and I know that this shouldn't... I hate to use that word. I'm going to get in trouble.
You and Barry Glendening.
Well, exactly. There you go. But, I mean, just in terms of, like, the post... It's still, like... To me, it's, like, still the post-Sir Alex Ferguson era in the league. And it's hard... It doesn't really... You know, a lot of people blame Mourinho for Chelsea being boring last season, but I don't think they necessarily were all the time. I don't think that's always fair. But it just doesn't feel like there's, like, there's a real heart to the league. There's no real Real Madrid sort of Barcelona tension. There's no major powerhouse like Bayern Munich, for example. There's no real locus of power in this league.
No one's
anymore.
Filling that void.
Yeah.
That was left behind by Ferguson.
And the thing is even Mourinho, as much as Mourinho is wonderful and says all these terrible things like about Munoz and his wife, this is dreadful. But really funny. There's a sense that how long is he going to be at Chelsea? Honestly, he's not a legacy manager. He's not going to be there longer than two or three more seasons.
I mean, he claims, you know, 10, 12 years. The problem is that the way he operates is so kind of high octane and so dramatic that really, I don't know that you can keep it up for that.
Yeah. And so when Wenger goes, it seems to me that, like, I think there'll be a major, I think there'll be like an identity crisis in that league for sure. I think they'll be like, they'll realize the jig is up, the 2000s are over, and they can't necessarily coast on their history for too much longer. So
yeah. I'm dreading that day.
Yeah.
On Jose, he said something, I think 2 days ago on the ESPN FC that I thought was interesting and probably right, but I just didn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
It was when he said, so Shaka Hislop asked him, he said, the first half of the season, you guys were amazing.
Yeah.
The way you played football, it was fluid, it was beautiful to watch. And then the second half of the season, it all went to crap.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we had injuries, we had fixture pileups, we had suspensions, and we had looked at it, and then we decided, well, we've earned the right to play this way because we're God knows how many points up on everybody. So we can be pragmatic because we've earned that right by playing that beautiful football in the first place. And I thought that was logical. And then I just got annoyed after, because you know, it's just I don't care if you earned it. Just play the way Wenger and Ferguson and those great teams used to play. Because last season, I think we all kind of felt a little bit let down by that title challenge.
Yeah, I mean, there's no team. I mean, the thing about Manchester United is, like, you got the sense that it was less. I mean, Sir Alex Ferguson would never plan that way. He would never say, well, you can take your foot off the gas. It wouldn't matter if he was 10 points up on second place. It would still be the same story. It's just they play in a certain way. It's angry all the time. It's, like, hyper-competitive to the point where if you're not a Manchester United fan, you hate the team because they were just relentless, right? And I just think that there's no team left like that. And it's sad to me because I loved Arsenal it's sad to me that Wenger didn't change in a way to sort of try to compete or fill that void when Ferguson left, even before he left, because I think that Ferguson overperformed, you know, the few seasons before he retired. But I think it feels like there's just a lack of players, like a lack of clubs where it's like I see that club play and I know that's the club. You know, it's like if I see Chelsea play, I know that's Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt even in the old Mourinho era, that was a team that I knew. I could tell that was a Chelsea team that played a particular way. And this time around, it's totally different. Does it feel like that?
Do you not? You don't feel that way about Arsenal then? Because I mean, they've you know, famously had a more passing style. I don't think it's always been to the level that people have claimed, especially in the last few years. But
yeah, but I mean, they
more so than other clubs. Perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, you could talk about they've lacked the sort of. I don't know. I don't want to talk about Arsenal because I've said this so many times, but like they've lacked the sort of, like, you know, I always think it's like when Vieira left, that just the real grit in the back of that team went with it, and they've always been chasing and trying to replace that since and haven't quite done it, unfortunately. So I just feel like Arsenal, when they're good, they're really fun to watch, but when they lose, it always seems like they're the ones losing. They're not being, you know. It's never the other team winning, it's them losing. You know what I mean? It's hard to describe.
Who's getting relegated?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, probably the usual suspects. Like,
I think it's Sunderland's time.
Yeah.
I've had enough.
Could be Villa. I mean, could honestly be Villa. The promoted teams, I always need to a few weeks to see to make a judgment. But, I think probably the usual suspects.
I think Norwich are like my second or third team just because I went to see them a couple times when I was a kid. And so far, the height of their recruitment has been Youssef Malumbu. So while they have a reasonable squad, I'm a bit worried about them.
Yeah. Well, at least they're not doing any, you know, Ricky Wolfsmith. Like,
well, has he come back yet? I don't know what's going on with him.
I have a friend of mine who I used to work with who's a hardcore Norwich fan. I actually used to be PR manager for them. So I hope they do well. Yeah. I'm praying.
One other team I want to quickly ask you about is Stoke. Who have just completed the signing of Ibrahim Afellay.
Stoke Alona.
Yeah.
So me and my colleague at work were discussing this today, and I asked him, you know, he's a Liverpool fan, and he was saying, I kind of fear going away to Stoke this season. And I said, do you fear it more now with the kind of Stoke ticky-tacka that we're about to possibly witness, or under Pulis when he had, you know, 15 mountain giants chucking boulders at you?
I don't know. It's like a wait and see. Like, the thing about Stoke is that Stoke never changed the way they played under Pulis, so it was extremely predictable. But I don't know if you could say the same this time around. It's really fun. It's like fun to see. It's fun to see like a team basically completely transform their ethos in a few years. But that tells you about, you know, the effect that Tony Pulis has wherever he goes. So I'm excited. I think it's really cool. I think it's just great for... I think it's a great of a fan of that club who's literally seen the, will have seen the entire spectrum. I don't think they're going to hit the heights of other teams that have gone down that route, but I think they're right for doing it because I think it pays dividends if it works. So it should be pretty cool.
Fair enough. And I suppose finally, thoughts about Newcastle, who for years never really did any real recruitment and have suddenly decided to do some?
I don't know. I mean, there's still so many question marks. I mean, last season was sort of like a... I mean, they're just sort of an... Yeah, exactly. You put it the exactly right way. It's still an aimless club. So, you know, I have friends of mine who know way more about Newcastle than I do and constantly use them as examples of what not to do, unfortunately. Like Dan Altman, who's a friend of mine. Who's
I wanted
always,
them to go down so bad. So bad.
I don't think it'll happen. But I mean, I don't know. They're just a club that's so hard to read. I mean, in some sense, they make really interesting decisions. They make some very, very interesting buys. I mean, obviously, the French Connection for a long time was would set them apart. Now, I don't know. It's impossible to see. And it's one of those things you just have to wait for the season to kick off, wait a few weeks, and then you can sort of paint by numbers and figure out what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But they're just such a really frustrating club in a lot of different ways. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to Mitrovic headbutting his first defender. Anyway, we better leave it there. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yeah.
Hopefully
it's a pleasure.
We can talk again in the future.
Yeah, anytime.
Thank you for downloading the KoshCast. Get in touch at underthekoshblog@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at under_thekosh. And for articles, predictions, and the full experience, go to underthekoshblog.com.